And joining us now is Jim Payne, the chief pilot for Airbus Perlin 2 project, and he's also a chairman of the board, and Morgan Sandercook, who's a pilot of the Perlin 2 aircraft and also the chief engineer. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So, Jim, tell me a little bit about being the chief pilot for this aircraft. Now, describe the mission kind of profile that you fly with this. This is not just a regular sailplane glider. It's a very, very high-altitude project.
So basically, I'm a graduate of the Air Force Test Pilot School. I've done many years in the Air Force testing aircraft. And we're just doing a build-up flight test program, just like we would with the FXX. And to date, we've expanded our envelope to 76,000 feet. The goal is to get to 90,000 feet. And given all the data that we've collected so far, especially flutter data, we've cleared ourselves to 90. So next time we go to Argentina, we'll be shooting for 90,000 feet.
Now, that is absolutely amazing. Now, tell us a little bit about the history of the Perlin project itself. This is something that's been going on for a number of years. It's not necessarily new, although this phase is a new phase in the program.
Exactly. Einar Einevoldsen, who founded the project with Steve Fawcett, was a soaring pilot and a research pilot at then NASA Dryden. And in the 90s, he was working at Grobe, and he saw this image that showed that there was mountain wave potentially in the stratosphere. Until that point, we assumed that most of the mountain waves, or all the mountain waves, were in the troposphere. So he did some research and discovered that in the polar regions in the wintertime, there are stratospheric mountain waves. So he and Steve Fawcett got connected. They modified a production sailplane and flew it to 51,000 feet in Patagonia. On the way down, they decided that they were very cold, so they'd want to build a pressurized sailplane that would be a little bit warmer. And also the pressure suits, when they get inflated at high altitude, become very stiff. You become kind of a Michelin man, and it's difficult to maneuver the controls and so on. So a pressurized sailplane makes it a much more pleasant experience and a much more fun experience.
I remember talking with some folks from the from that original flight, the 51,000 foot flight, and at that time it was the difficulties you describe, not being pressurized, being very cold, and having to wear those pressure suits were really hindering how high they would be able to go. So in this iteration, what is different about the Perlin 2?
Well, the Perlin 2 has a pressurized cabin, and basically, it is a space capsule with a very low leak rate, and as any air leaks out, we add scuba air from a tank that's in the fuselage boom, and it's been a very successful system for us. Typically, we're working with a cabin altitude around 14 to 16,000 feet, depending on our set point. I've recently been using higher set points just to reduce the stress. It's designed for 8.5 PSI differential, and so far, it's worked like a charm.
So at 14 to 16,000 feet, is the crew on oxygen as well?
Yes, we're using rebreathers. We're breathing 100% oxygen. It turns out if you breathe 100% oxygen on a normal system, that your body doesn't metabolize at all. So when you exhale, you're exhaling oxygen into the cabin. And with a sealed cabin, that would be a dangerous situation because the concentration of oxygen would rise over time and potentially increase the fire risk to an unacceptable level. So we are using a rebreather, and that's been a huge success for us too. The rebreather system, of course, has an exhaust hose which goes to a CO2 scrubber to take the CO2 out of the breathing loop.
Now, is that something that was designed for this project, or was that something that was already available, the rebreather?
Well, rebreather technology has been used by the mining industry for safety devices as well as the diving industry. The system that we're using is adapted from a system that was developed as an emergency system for miners.
Describe the aircraft itself. What's it made out of? What's the wingspan? If we saw it, well, we're going to see it later today actually fly, but describe for folks who are not here, how did it come to be?
The layout of the glider follows a conventional glider layout. People fly in the cockpit in tandem, one in front of the other. Conventional tail, conventional wings. We chose a 25-meter wingspan because there's a lot of gliders built at 25 meters. It's a conventional size that we know how to handle on the ground. So that limits us to 90,000. We really want to go higher, but in order to have a practical airplane that we can actually maneuver on the ground, we decided that 90,000 was going to be a great altitude.
And how do you predict where the these waves are? Is there a standard formula that you can follow, or is it something you just have to sort of sense as you're going through it?
Well, we have lots of experience now with mountain waves. Also, computer models have gotten very good. So we have computer models of the waves in Patagonia as well as waves in North America. And through those predictions, we're able to pick the good days to fly.
And when you say good days, what kind of conditions are you looking for, aside from the mountain wave? Is there certain thunderstorms, whatever, the atmosphere is rolling? Or
the mountain wave is driven by the wind speed.
Okay.
So we need high-speed wind at high altitude. And the unique thing about where we fly is we're flying in the polar vortex, which gives us extremely high-speed wind at 100,000 feet in the stratosphere, where there normally is not wind.
So as you're up in those regions, what is it like to fly the airplane? I mean, I would think that you're getting to a point where your speed and the stall speed start to come together, as in some of the high-altitude airplanes like the SR-71 or the U-2, where they're coffin corner, as it were?
Yes, there is a limit, but we've got a pretty big margin between our stall speed and our maximum flying speed, so we're pretty safe from that point of view. The glider was designed to be most efficient at 60,000 feet. The wings want to fly at 60,000 feet. And the amazing thing is you can feel that in the cockpit. You can feel this glider wants to fly at that altitude.
So where do you take off from? Are you taking off from a higher altitude airports?
Yeah. Well, we've been using El Calafate in southern Argentina, and it's about 750 feet MSL.
Okay, so not much over sea level.
Yes.
So that makes it for a long climb to get to your target altitude. How do you get off the ground?
Well, in recent years, we've been towed by an Egret, which is an airplane that was developed for high altitude. So we've now made 11 tows over 40,000 feet, our highest tow being to 47,100. And basically what that does is it allows us to tow straight to the stratosphere so we can enter the stratospheric wave. It takes about an hour to get there. The climb rate is around 1,200 feet a minute behind the Egret. Pretty amazing tow plane.
We're talking with Jim Payne and Morgan Sandercook from the Airbus Perlin 2 project. And we want to recognize Airbus because they came on board to help support this this project moving forward.
Absolutely. Airbus has been a fantastic partner. And it's gotten even better. We're working on a project called Blue Condor with Airbus, with a hydrogen-powered jet glider. So maybe next year we'll have the jet-powered glider here.
That would be awesome. What's the schedule of your next attempt to go high?
Well, the polar vortex is best in the wintertime at the particular pole. We have been to Argentina several times, and the best period appears to be late July through early September. So that's the period in 2023 that we plan to be back in Argentina.
So what kind of planning goes into that expedition for next year?
Well, it's kind of like a major military operation.
Right.
Our home base is Minden, Nevada. The glider fits in a trailer, and the trailer goes in a 40-foot container. So we load that and all our spares, goes on a truck to the harbor at Long Beach or Los Angeles. And then it goes by slow boat to Chile, and then by truck across the Andes to Mendoza, Argentina, and then on down south to El Calafate. So that's a long process.
Have you had any resistance from the Argentine government, or are they cooperating with what you're trying to do?
They've been very cooperative, and the local officials, as well as the Aero Club that's in El Calafate, they've been absolutely fantastic. They've bent over backwards to help us, so
good.
We consider them true friends.
Excellent. Now, this isn't just a platform for flying high. You're also doing some experiments when you are up in the upper reaches of the stratosphere.
What are some
of those?
We have some experiments permanently installed in the glider. We're looking at ozone measurements. We've got measurements of cosmic rays. We're measuring temperature. And at the same time, we've got a program through Teachers in Space where school children have contributed experiments that we carry on board in a CubeSat rack. And we can take the classroom experiments up with us. And then the kids in the classroom watch us on the internet in our virtual cockpit so they can see where we are and how high we're going.
That is amazing. Technology is brings the world together through a project like this, or even some of the streaming cameras that we have here to be able to continue to spread the message. What's some of the more interesting school projects that you've taken up?
The most interesting one was actually by an elementary school class who gave us a marshmallow. And the experiment is the marshmallow expands with low pressure, but then it freezes when it gets cold. Does it freeze first or does it expand first? That's real basic science that the elementary school kids came up with.
And the answer is?
I didn't inspect the marshmallow myself. Someone else ate the marshmallow.
Well, that's great. So what's the future hold for the Perlin project? After you go back next year, let's say you reach your target altitudes, what will you be looking at beyond that?
Well, the Perlin is considered by our group a science project, and we're looking for science payloads to carry to high altitude. So anybody that has a science payload that needs to go to high altitude in a good environment should contact the Perlin project.
And with that, how do they contact you or follow your mission and your exploits?
Well, perlinproject.org. We have a nice website. There's blogs on there. There are places where people can sign up for our social media and for our virtual cockpit. So every time we fly, we have this virtual cockpit, which takes our telemetry and puts up a virtual cockpit so you can sit there and see our position, altitude, and you can check our oxygen and our battery levels and kind of go along for the ride.
Excellent. And we'll look forward to seeing the airplane, both airplanes, the Grove and the Perlin, in the air show today, doing a little bit of a demonstration. So are either of you flying?
Both of us.
Both of you? Okay.
Yes, yep. Got to fly with a co-pilot in this glider.
All right. Yes. Well, good. We'll make sure we wave from down here, if you wave back, right?
It's only small windows, very small windows.
Okay. Jim Payne and Morgan Sandercook from the Perlin 2 project, sponsored by Airbus. Thanks for joining us today. This is From the Stand. I'm Steve Buss on EIA Radio.